Hello and welcome to Conversations with the Boyce of Reason. I'm your host, Benjamin Boyce, and today's guest is attorney Ramsey Rammerman, who has 20 years of experience litigating open government and First Amendment cases. He's also highly versed in public records issues. And Section 230. Section 230 governs the way in which the government perceives of social media companies as either platforms or as publishers. And Section 230 is brought up quite a bit when YouTubers and people that are concerned with social media talk about censorship, freedom of speech, and the balance of powers between social media companies and the end user. Now, I didn't know a lot about Section 230, even though it has a big impact on my well-being. So I'm very grateful that Ramsey had some time to spend to school me on these issues, and I'm very proud to offer his expertise to you. Without further ado, here is Ramsey Rammerman. What got you into First Amendment issues and social media? You've written a couple articles, at least that you shared with me, but it sounded like you put a lot of thought into that.
Yeah, so I started getting my main area of focus is on open government issues. And one of the cases I had about 10 years ago now was dealing with the issue of metadata and when metadata is part of a public record. And so the case itself dealt with the issue of whose copy of an email did the city need to produce? And the request wanted a copy of an email sent to one council member, and the city had produced an email, the same email, but sent to a different council member. And while the email looks the same, under the metadata underneath it is not going to be the same. And just simply because part of the metadata collects the path the email takes to the internet, and if it goes to different people, it's going to have a slightly different path. And so I had been litigating that for a couple of years, and when the court ruled that the metadata was part of the public record, it got me thinking about social media, because there, you know, usually the user's not going to have access to all the underlying code and metadata, so it's going to, you know, they're not going to be able to produce that metadata. And if somebody requests their social media post, they can do a screenshot or whatever, but they aren't going to be able to produce the underlying code, which is going to be part of the metadata. So that just got me interested in it. Mm-hmm. And then, and I've always been interested in First Amendment issues. I had been litigating a couple First Amendment cases for a while, dealing with the rights of association. And so when I started looking at this issue of public records and social media, I quickly saw that there's also a huge First Amendment issue, or a couple of huge First Amendment issues. That just got me interested in it. Mm-hmm. And since then, I've done a bunch of presentations on the issues and such, and none of them directly deal with Section 230. But obviously, once you're interested in First Amendment issues and social media, you'll be drawn to Section 230 issues. And so then I've just been following them and looking at it, and that's got inspired me to write, as you said, a couple articles mm-hmm. for the Federalist. And, mm-hmm. I've also been doing really tracking the Trump versus Knight case, which was now Biden versus Knight, that the Supreme Court just rejected cert on. This is the one with Justice Thomas's opinion, because I found that to be it's a fascinating issue dealing with the rights of association and the rights of speech. And so, and that's something that's very real to the attorneys that I'm speaking to in my presentations, because they're all municipal attorneys. And so they have to give guidance to elected officials on this issue. So,
in what capacity, and with regards to officials speaking or hanging out with the wrong people? Is that what it is?
It's more the issue of first the issue of whether you create a forum and whether, you know, people responding have any First Amendment right to comment on what you're saying, and then whether you could block them or otherwise, you know, not engage with them. Mm-hmm. And so,
like,
that's,
on a website, yeah, I guess, exactly. Basically, generally, okay. I
mean, and really, what the Court of Appeals decision in Trump versus, or Knight versus Trump, this is the Knight First Amendment Foundation from Columbia Law School. They sued President Trump for blocking people, and by blocking people, he was excluding them from his comment section. And so the issue in that case, becomes whether you've created a public forum or not when they're using this space. It's kind of like, I think Justice Thomas analogizes it to, if government rents out a private hotel room for a public meeting, then that private hotel room suddenly becomes a public forum. Mm-hmm. And so the issue is, what is happening on social media when a politician is using social media? And so the Court of Appeals had ruled that Trump's Twitter feed was a public forum, primarily because he was using that to make official pronouncements on behalf of the United States. But the issue is really much more complicated than that, because while Trump used it as the president, he also used it as a political actor. And in a political actor, he's acting as a private individual. And as a private individual, he has a First Amendment right to choose who he associates with when he's talking politics. And so, the court had to kind of determine which of those characteristics predominate. And they held for Trump that it was sufficiently a public forum because he was using it for official pronouncements. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he could take unilateral action over Twitter as well, in theory. Although that's,
Well, like nuke the servers or storm the offices of Twitter.
That like he was waiving any confidentiality protection and ordering the release of certain records. Okay. So that would be, now a court has subsequently ruled that actually was not binding, but we didn't know that for sure.
Wow.
He used it for official diplomacy, like his tweets at the Kim Jong-il or whatever the name of the current North Korean dictator is. And so, it's official communications. And so that's the official use, but he obviously used it for private use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It further complicated by whether the person is an executive, because a legislative official never has the ability to exercise official authority unilaterally. They only can exercise authority as with their other legislators. Mm-hmm. Whereas an executive official can take unilateral action. So maybe could use Twitter for official action like the president had. Hmm. And so just advising municipal attorneys who need to advise their council members and mayors and such on, how to use social media. It also comes into play in just any of the city's websites. Anytime you're allowing comments from the public, you have the issue of, are you creating a forum or not? And so I've been tracking, there's been a bunch of cases dealing with that even outside of the social media sphere, but just anytime you're allowing comments, mm-hmm. Are you creating a website? And if a city allows advertising on a website, what are the rules there? Have they done it in a way they can open it up to make it a public forum, or they can keep it government speech, which is not a public forum? And so the issue gets really into the weeds here, but
yeah, really sticky.
I think I'd be happy to talk about, the nuances of what creates a public forum or not, but we'll need a few more hours for that. So.
Yeah, right. Well, I guess what would be most useful for myself and my audience is kind of understanding the lay of the land with regards to public or private citizens and private companies. So people talk about 230. Nobody's really explained it to me. I'd be really well served by like a brief primer on that if you feel competent in doing that. And then kind of mapping out, the tensions between, free speech versus private platforms versus private citizens.
Yeah, no, this is definitely would be more than willing to do that. So I think the easiest way is to start with what Section 230 says, and then talk about what the law was like before Section 230 was enacted to kind of determine its purpose, which I think helps one understand what exactly Section 230 really is doing. And then we can talk about what can be done, and that kind of gets into what Justice Thomas has been talking about in a couple of his opinions recently. Mm-hmm. So Section 230 is it's Section 230 of the 1996 Communications Decency Act. And it has a variety of sections, but the one that everybody cites to is subsection C. And subsection C has two subsections. And would it be helpful? I could put it up on this. I could share my screen with you and
have. I could put that in later.
Okay.
It'd be easier for me to edit. Maybe you can send me the thing. Okay, you can read from it though, and I can throw it up there.
Yeah, no problem. But so section C1 is entitled Treatment as a Publisher or Speaker. So let me actually take a step back. So 230 sub C is called Protection for Good Samaritan Blocking and Screening of Offensive Material. And then in sub 1 is Treatment of Publisher or Speaker. And it states that no provider or user of interactive computer services, which is basically social media, shall be treated as a publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. And so what this first section is saying that a social media company is not going to be liable for the speech of users who publish that speech on their website. And then section 2 is entitled Civil Liability, and it says no provider or user of interactive computer services, so social media, shall be held liable on account of, and then sub A is any action voluntarily taken in good faith to restrict access to or availability of material that the provider or user considers obscene, lewd, and it goes on for a while and then ends with, or otherwise objectionable, whether or not such material is constitutionally protected. And sub B deals with spam filters. So basically what this is saying is that normally, let's take a step back here and talk about what the law was before, because that will explain what they're trying to do with this. So generally, the courts have recognized that obviously someone is liable for their own speech, but they've also looked at when are you liable for other people's speeches. And the courts have generally held that, or have exclusively held that, the publisher of someone else's writing is liable just as to the same extent that the author is. And this is because a publisher has, you know, has editorial ability to change that speech any way they want before they publish it.
Okay. Yeah.
And therefore they're considered to be on full notice of what it is, and they're fully liable for that. The courts have also recognized that other people involved in the delivery of speech have a different level of liability, and these are distributors. And so the distributor is the, you know, the vehicles that deliver the published writings to retail outlets, and then the retail outlets themselves. And here the court has held that the distributor is only liable for speech that is either defamatory or obscene if the distributor knows or has reason to know that it's obscene or defamatory. And so that's, in general, your bookstore is not going to be liable for defamatory content in books it sells unless it knows it's defamatory. Now, defamation, you're almost a distributor is almost never going to know speech is actually defamatory, because there's, you know, how do you know something is truly false? And it has to be more than false. It has to be able to deceive someone. And so usually that doesn't come into play, but it does come into play with obscenity, which is basically what it's saying is if you see a nearly naked girl on the cover of a magazine, you have a duty to open it up to see if the content is obscene or not. So that's kind of how that played out. So you had these two levels of liability. And the publisher's ability to edit is really important because that's rooted in the First Amendment right of association. The editor has the right to choose who they publish and has full control to edit it and such. And the Supreme Court has previously said that the right to respond was the laws that were passed in the 60s and 70s that said if somebody says something bad about you, you have a right to respond. And they would require newspapers to basically publish editorials by someone responding. And the Supreme Court said that's unconstitutional because a publisher has the right to choose who he associates with or not, and the government can't force him to associate. Can't force a publisher to associate with somebody they don't want to. And so that's part of the justification for making the publisher liable for who they publish, because they have complete control of whether or not they publish someone. We get to, we have the distributor liability and the publisher liability, and then social media starts up, and there's two early cases that deal with this issue, dealing with message boards. So this is 1990s, early 1990s. So very, not even really social media, but these message boards. And so the first case is the Chubby case, and it's Chubby versus. So it's Chubby versus CompuServe, and in that case, CompuServe had had these message boards, but it did not do any editing, any screening or anything. It was just the Wild West, and so they CompuServe sued for libel based on posts that were made by some anonymous user, and the court. And the so Chubby said, or CompuServe said, well, we're not liable. We're just a distributor. And, of course, the plaintiff said, no, you're a publisher. And the court looked at it and said, well, given that CompuServe doesn't do any type of editing, they are just a distributor. And so they weren't liable. And so that case.
Is this kind of the origin of the publisher versus platform? Distributor and platform's equitable.
Yeah, they get used interchangeably.
Okay, good.
And so that was the first case. Then the second case was Stratton Oakmont versus Prodigy, another message board case. But in this case, Prodigy had put itself out as a family-friendly message board because, of course, by 1994 or so, when this case first came up, they had already learned the lesson that if you allow people to publish whatever they want on the internet, they will. And so this was a family-friendly. So they had rules against, obscene conduct and swearing and such. And they had a person assigned to each of the message boards that was supposed to kind of look through. And then they had a screening mechanism that caught certain words that would block a post. But pretty light editing still, but some level of editing. And so they were sued again for defamation. And here the court said, well, you are actually engaging in editing. Editing power is the power of a publisher. So you're a publisher, and therefore you're liable for all of the speech on your message boards as a publisher. And so that case, if it had held, it would have just killed the internet right there, because it's just not realistic to expect a social media site to be able to ensure that what everybody else posts is not defamatory. And so that led to the adoption of Section 230. And so it has its first provision saying, you know, the treatment of publisher speaker, saying that the social media companies shall not be treated as a publisher of other people's content. And then civil liability, saying that they aren't going to be liable for when they edit or censor conduct. And then it gives a list of whether it's obscene or lewd or lascivious or filthy, excessively violent, harassing, or otherwise objectionable.
Yeah, which is the sneaky one.
And it's done in good faith. Now, I think that one of the problems that we've had is that if you look at the two cases I just discussed, there was this link between how much editing you do and whether you were going to be held as a publisher. But the language in 230 doesn't link these two provisions expressly. And so courts have generally treated this as creating two different liabilities. One for you aren't liable for other people's defamation. And then you also, a social media company also isn't liable for its censorship. But I think that that is it's not accurately interpreting at least what the law was like that they were trying to address, because these really ought to be linked. And I think really what it ought to be saying is that as long as you censor in good faith, you won't be held liable as a publisher.
And there would have to be some sort of reasonable level of evidence that good or bad faith is being applied.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And if we could require all censorship by social media companies to be done in good faith, then that would, you know, I think resolve most of the problems. Because
what does that look like?
So, you know, good faith as a legal term can mean a variety of things. But here I would say the most reasonable interpretation of good faith would be basic due process protections. And what these mean is very well defined in, you know, for government, when it enacts a law, it has to meet due process standards. So it has to provide people with fair notice of what is being censored or what is being prohibited. And it has to enforce those in a non-arbitrary manner. And I think that, you know, require social media companies to, first off, adopt their censorship rules, you know, clearly have them written out. And those rules have to be definitive enough that your average person has a good idea of what they mean. Because mm-hmm. right now what we see is social media companies have rules that say, you know, that they can censor you for any reason they want, basically. Mm-hmm. Or no reason at all for some of them. And so it just doesn't allow the user to know what the rules are going to be in advance. Mm-hmm. And they rely on the language of otherwise objectionable to say we can make whatever we want objectionable. And that's fine. And I think actually there's very good reasons to give them that broad authority. Mm-hmm. But if they had to actually adopt those reasons ahead of time before they censor you, that would end up providing significant protections. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's what the law was meant to, that's how it should be interpreted. And it still could be interpreted that way. The meaning of Section 230 has not been definitively established by the Supreme Court.
Okay.
And there's actually a surprisingly few lower court decisions that deal with how these two provisions interact together. I think that there's real possibility there. But so what ends up happening right now is because certainly the social media companies treat these as two separate provisions, they believe they have a right there. They can't be liable for anything anybody says, and they can censor you for any reason they want. And they don't have to act, and they don't necessarily.
There's no accountability there.
Yeah, there's no accountability. And when these two provisions are not unreviewable, and that's because
could you repeat that when these general, two provisions are
are when they aren't interpreted as being conditional related to each other, and they're treated as two separate protections. There is no easy way to challenge the interpretation of the censorship authority to ensure it's done in good faith, because in general, the First Amendment protects, you know, gives everybody a right to censor in bad faith if they want. We have, it goes back to the publisher can choose to publish whatever work he wants to or doesn't want to. And there isn't any, you don't have any right to force them to, you know, publish your work. And so when it comes to, you know, how do we challenge, if you're saying they censored me and they didn't censor me in good faith, there just isn't, there generally isn't going to be a cause of action that would allow you to raise that challenge because they have a First Amendment right to censor you in bad faith.
Is there significant enough power or, I guess, teeth behind this or these provisions, Section 230, et cetera, to put social media companies, especially big ones, Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, put them in the position of adopting very clear rules for censorship with good notice? Like, how do you force them to do that? And what's the apparatus that would get them into that position?
So first, if Section 230 was interpreted as conditional, it would be a way to get them there, because what you would say is, you aren't entitled to immunity for defamation because you have not censored people in good faith. Okay. And so the, you know, if they were conditioned on each other, it would force social media companies to act responsibly. And it would really, I think, really change it, because not only would they have to adopt rules ahead of time, but it would also mean that any of their shadow censorship would violate the statute, because good faith necessarily includes notice of the censorship.
Generally speaking, they would be, their protections would be discarded. The protections, legal protections.
Yeah, all their, okay. Yeah. So basically, if these two provisions are linked, then they would know that if they want to keep their, you know, immunity from defamation, they need to make sure they're doing their censorship activities in good faith. Other ways to try and force this is trying to figure out what causes of action can bring about a right to sue them for censoring. And so the case the Supreme Court denied cert for back in October, this was the Malwarebytes case from the Ninth Circuit, is an example of this. And there it was a lawsuit between two companies that created basically spam filters or, you know, web browsing filters. And the second provision in 230C 2B basically says that you also get immunity if you develop a spam filter, as long as it's done in good faith for reasons you find objectionable. But what was happening here was one of the companies, Malwarebytes, had specifically built into its filtering program something to block its competitors.
Oh.
And so one of the competitors sued Malwarebytes for interference with business expectancy and anti-competitive under antitrust activities. And so then the Ninth Circuit, in looking at this, said, well, because this was done for an anti-competitive purpose, it wasn't done in good faith, and therefore Section 230 immunity didn't apply. Mm-hmm. And so the trying to find the right cause of action that would bring up something like that with defamation might do it. But it is definitely difficult, because the lower courts have generally uniformly not linked these two provisions, and they've interpreted the immunity for other users' content as basically incredibly broad, to say the least.
Mm-hmm. And so what will need to happen is the right case with the right judge and the right circumstance to kind of bond those two provisions, or to kind of reformulate how the law sees that section.
Yeah. I mean, that's how we'd have to do it in the courts, is to get, you know, a brave judge, the right facts, and then have it go up high enough, you know, so that it either establishes a circuit decision that will be influential, or makes it to the Supreme Court and gives a definitive interpretation. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, obviously Section 230 could be amended. I mean, you know, you could, a really simple amendment would be to link the two. You could simply stick in the word "as a publisher" into the second mm-hmm. section, and that would link the two, and then that would make it clear.
Which would be the legislature would do.
Yeah, it would have to go through Congress. Okay. President Trump in September, the DOJ put out a comprehensive proposal for amending Section 230 that would have done this. It would have also done some other bad stuff, but it would have linked these two and given real meat to the term good faith, because good faith could be interpreted to mean less than due process protections. But they made it clear that that's what it would be required, is clear notice and then a fair adjudicative process. But obviously trying to get Congress to do anything like that controversial would be extremely difficult.
In today's climate, what could possibly go wrong? And what's up with Justice Thomas and his recent fiddling around with this or going over it? What's your analysis of that and the content of what he's doing?
Yeah, so he is trying to look at, could we somehow restrict the ability of social media companies to censor based on viewpoint, based on political bias? And that's a lot harder to do. Because it's the government is just not, and even the courts are not well equipped to detect and identify political bias. But I'll take a couple steps back here. So what he has been arguing, so he's issued two opinions agreeing with the denial of cert, but explaining his reasons. Basically, he's taken these opportunities where the Supreme Court has denied cert in these two cases, and the justices are always allowed to add an opinion to that denial saying why they think it's a good or a bad idea.
Cert and meaning?
Certiorari is when you file something and you want the Supreme Court to review, the petition is called a cert petition, certiorari petition. And so cert we use as this kind of shorthand for it. And so when the Supreme Court accepts a case, we call it granting cert.
Okay.
And if they denied it,
but there's reasons that can be appended to why.
And all of the justices could say something or say nothing. Normally the courts say nothing, but every once in a while a justice will express their opinion. And here, so in the first case, in the Malwarebytes case, he took it as an opportunity to kind of lay out the history that I just described to you with the early cases and the difference between publisher liability and distributor liability. And he argued in that case that if Section 230 was enacted in response to the Chubby and Strantmont cases, then the end result should be treating social media as a distributor, not completely immune from liability. And so I think that may be a reasonable interpretation, but it's been rejected by the court so far. Obviously, the Supreme Court hasn't weighed in, so they could take that position. But one of the earliest cases that reached the circuit courts very clearly rejected that argument, saying that basically, because once you have notice of something as defamatory, you would have to remove it. It would basically cause social media to, anytime somebody complains, they immediately remove it, because that way they'd avoid liability, mm-hmm. whether or not it's defamatory. So I don't think mm-hmm. that solution of just allowing them to be distributors would really work with social media. But Justice Thomas is certainly, makes a good argument that, you know, it would seem to be that's what they were intending, because that's what in the Chubby case they held it was a distributor and wasn't liable. But But so he goes through basically why he thinks that's what Section 230 is really doing or should be doing. And then in this latest case, the Biden versus Knight, or Trump versus Knight, it was renamed Biden versus Knight because this lawsuit was against the president in his official capacity. And so when you get a new president, you switch the names. But it is kind of odd that it's under Biden. But there he was looking at, you know, what is our authority to regulate people's, regulate, you know, private speech? And he noted that we have for a class of companies that we call common carriers. And these have, for, you know, well before the establishment of the United States and England, recognized that they can't deny service because you dislike them. They might be able to deny service because you didn't pay or you were really disruptive and got kicked off or whatever. And this would usually be transport originally. And then, but it's also now applies to telephone companies. And basically it's saying that these common carriers are basically like utilities, and the utilities aren't allowed to discriminate based on viewpoint. You know, they can't only provide electricity to Democrats, and telephone services are can't limit who they provide to. And so he is suggesting in this latest opinion that social media companies look a lot more like these common carriers or utilities. And so Congress could, or he's suggesting that Congress could enact restrictions on their ability to discriminate based on political views. But there's a couple problems with this in the nature that are in the nature of social media and the nature of the ability to restrict. When we talk about utilities, it's a very binary thing. It's you can't, you know, use anything. You have to serve everybody. And I don't think that wouldn't work with social media, because while Twitter generally could serve everybody, lots of social media sites are very specific and they want to limit, you know, what topics are discussed. You know, you can go to, I think it's Revelry. Is that the knitting site? You know, they knitting here. And so, you know, they wanted to adopt a rule that says we don't want any political talk on here. That would be fine. But under Justice Thomas's analysis, as a common carrier, you couldn't make any limitation like that. You'd really have to accept all comers. Everyone would have to accept all comers if you did it that way.
Unless you had some sort of market cap, like once you get like 10 million users, then you have to change.
Yeah, which you could have some non-viewpoint based limit on it, like if they didn't pay, you could kick them off or whatever. Yeah. But you couldn't limit it. And so there's good reason to want to take, you know, viewpoint into account when setting up a social media site. So it would dramatically change the nature of a lot of social media sites. Mm-hmm. But it's also really difficult to be more nuanced than that if you're doing it on political viewpoints, because how do you, you know, what is, you know, when are they censoring you for your political viewpoints versus something else? How do we draw the line that, you know, are you really discriminating against Republicans, or are you discriminating against someone for a different reason? And I think courts would have a hard time, you know, drawing whatever that other line is, trying to figure it out. And it would again, you know, bog down these issues. And certainly part of Section 230 was trying to get government out of the way as much as possible on this to allow the free flowing of speech.
Yeah. Well, so and the development of business in this brand new space as well, I'm sure.
And then finally, there is a line of cases that deal with utilities. And while utilities could be made to do all comers, you can't force a utility to carry political speech. And so there were the lead case dealt with a city that contracted with a private utility, and it wanted to force that utility to carry political propaganda in the bills. And so basically what you're doing there is you're compelling these private utility companies to deliver the government's political speech. So it's a compelled speech issue. And the court said, no, you can't do that. And so really, if we were forcing social media companies to carry, users who are espousing political beliefs that the social media company doesn't want to espouse, you're compelling them to carry that speech. And we can't do, even being a utility doesn't justify the government compelling people to take that, to carry speech they don't want to do.
Yeah, it's just there's a matter of scale when you have something like YouTube that is facilitating such a huge amount of information distribution. And I understand to some degree that they want to limit that or to not host certain content. Let's just be very obvious. Like, they don't want to host porn. That they're saying that that's obscene. But underneath the hood, the amount of manipulation that their algorithm does connecting users, it's phenomenal. Like how there's no provisions that I've seen anywhere in the law that even recognizes that's what's going on with the way that information is being organized and distributed. And there, it seems like they're trending toward giving more and more prominence to older players, to the MSNBC and the Fox and stuff, and creators such as me, up and coming, filling in a niche, a very small niche, our stuff are kind of getting pushed to the side. So there's this kind of, there's this potential for such great amounts of sharing of information that is stymied by certain realistic things. Like, they ultimately, they need to make money, so they're going to go and serve people who can give them money. And ultimately, they probably have some sort of political bias that they will openly or closely push. Plus, they have all this morality that they want to put in to be against hate and be for, let's say, equity, diversity, inclusion. And so that's going to cause them to start to discriminate between people based on all these characteristics that they want to write. So I don't know to what extent government has any say, but the consumer is kind of left in the lurch here.
Yeah, I mean, as the general sense consensus or thought of how Section 230 should be interpreted, it really creates this massive, massive authority that's never existed before in these social media companies, because they have the complete ability to manipulate the speech that comes out, yet they aren't liable for it because all they're doing is saying, we'll let this person speak, but not let this person speak. And I really think that it's contrary to, it's certainly proven to be very negative. Now, there was a really interesting case that came out of the Ninth Circuit a couple years ago. It was roommates.com or something like that. And what it held was that in this case, the website was liable for the discriminatory conduct of people who were posting apartments for rent on their website, because roommates.com created a template, and one of those templates, or a couple of them, dealt with issues of whether you had kids or not and what gender you were, and they were violating the discrimination laws, or the posts ended up violating the discrimination laws because they said, no kids. And so when the roommates.com was sued, they said, no, we have Section 230. We didn't create these posts. And the court said, while you didn't create the content of the posts, you created the template that invited these users to, opine on these improper categories, like whether you have kids or not. And therefore, your actions made you partially responsible for their speech because you were controlling the content of their speech to a certain extent.
Huh. That's just weird, because isn't that freedom of association? I get to choose who I want to roommate with. And if I don't want a roommate with a child,
Well, it's certain, the right to freedom of association is, it depends, your rights, government can still have anti-discrimination laws on that. Like, if you want a roommate, you can't choose to have, you can't say that I want, no Norwegian roommates or no, Asian roommates or something. You can't discriminate based on race in choosing.
You can't say that out loud, but you can either accept or reject people later on down the road.
But you're never doing it for that reason. Or you're not saying you're doing it for that reason, whatever's in your heart, who knows, but the anti-discrimination laws do interfere with our right to association. And so what the courts have said is, whether you can apply anti-discrimination laws, will depend on the nature of the association. And if you are just your average association, like your average business, because a business is an association, they have association with their customers, we will apply anti-discrimination laws. But if you're an expressive association, then you have a greater ability to discriminate. And so there's two cases dealing with gay rights in this issue, and this is the Hurley case, which came out of Boston, and it had to do with the St. Patrick's Day parade, and which was a private event, and the organizers did not want to allow the Gay Police Officers Association to march in the parade. And the court held that they had the right to do that because a parade is quintessential expressive association, and the organizers have the right to control the nature of the message of that parade. And if they feel that allowing the gay police officers to march in it would dilute or change the message they wanted to convey, then it would violate their right to association and their right to speech. And then we have the Boy Scouts case, where they said that you cannot be a scout leader if you're gay. And the court again held that the Boy Scouts was an expressive association meant to promote clean and straight living, which was in their pamphlet. And therefore, because it's an expressive association, they have the right to discriminate against someone if that would interfere with their rights. And this is the same thing that happened in that recent case dealing with that beauty pageant, where the beauty pageant excluded trans women from being in it. And the court said they can do that because it's expressive and their message is, you know, doesn't include that. So they can exclude on that basis. But if it's a business, they don't have the same rights to exclude on that basis. It gets more confusing and it easily becomes confusing. But generally, if you're like the lead case from the Supreme Court, it deals with the JCs, which is a charitable organization, and they didn't allow women to be voting members. And the court said, well, there's nothing about the JCs mission, which was mainly charitable, that would be interfered with if we forced you to accept women. So you do have to accept women. And so that kind of goes with association, and I forgot where we started in this question.
We got into the associative weeds there, but the magnitude of social media, again, Twitter to a lesser extent, but Facebook greatly, and YouTube, well, I'm speaking personally here, it doesn't seem like the law has any precedent to deal with such wide-ranging authority. And this authority is actually gets kind of scary because Facebook has actually done experiments to change voting patterns in certain municipalities. These companies can actually shape our government. They are actually, in certain respects, more powerful than any private entity that we've known before, even to a certain extent, public entity we've known. So what do you see? Do you see that there's going to be a clash, or do you see that they'll lobby their way into, you know, getting away with whatever?
I think there's going to be a clash one way or the other. I think, so I remember where I was going with this on the roommates.com. So you're brought up the right of association, but I think what's relevant in the roommates case is a recognition that when a social media company is taking steps to shape the message to such an extent, there's a point where they cross the line and suddenly it becomes partially their speech because of how they're shaping the message. Now, the roommates.com was easy because they had easy to show that because they had developed the template. Yeah. But I think what the social media companies are doing is the same type thing. They're clearly shaping the message that's delivered. I mean, you can, you know, a variety of things that you can see it. I think, you know, the suppression of the Hunter Biden laptop story is the best example, the most dramatic example of how they are using their authority to censor, not just to block speech that's objectionable, but to actually shape the entire message that's coming out of them and shape the narrative. The problem is, how do you prove that, and how do you, you know, get under the hood? Because roommates.com had prepared a template, so it was easy to prove, you know, how do we get there? And that's why I think the Veritas leaks have been so interesting, because they are at least anecdotal evidence to suggest that there really is this motive to shape what's going on out there. But it's just going to, it's the type of thing that is, doesn't easily lend itself to proof, absent some smoking gun, you know, documents that kind of give the roadmap of this is how we're going to alter the messages that are coming off our sites. But there is a level of interference that that should turn the social media company sites into at least a partial speaker of the message, so that they could be held liable. But we don't know. We don't know exactly where that is or how to prove that yet.
So what do you recommend for people that are concerned about this, and like, where would we, where do you suggest we put our energy into to advocate for? Your articles mentioned that if we focus on terms of service, if we focus on fair rules that are transparent and that are equally or non-arbitrarily applied, it seems like that's a very strong place to start.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think that if we could get these basic due process protections in place, I think it would, you know, solve the complaints about social media censorship, or at least most of them. One of the things that I hear from a lot of YouTubers is, if I just knew what the rules were ahead of time and they weren't going to be changed on me, then I could function my business and I could do it. And I think that that's what the, you know, if we had the due process protections, it would get us there. And then also the arbitrary enforcement is the other half of that. I think that would solve most of our problems. Now, how to get there is really, right now, you know, if we assume Congress is basically worthless on this point, it's experimenting in lawsuits finding the right lawsuit. And I would see, I would like to see something that where we have the fact that they have censored speech is done in a way that we could call it, it's actually them speaking. So when they censor you, they slander you. And there was one case that had made this claim successfully, almost, where the court held that the statement they were removed, their video was removed for because of basically spamming conduct to build up the likes falsely. I forget the exact phrase that they had done it. But the notice, basically, if you tried to go to that video, it'd say, this video has been removed for violation of our terms of service. And the plaintiff said that that statement was slanderous because we didn't violate their terms of service, and they're, you know, so they're, and they're just doing this for this, you know, claim that, you know, that isn't based on the content of our video. It's based on this extraneous content. And so the court said that that was not blocked by Section 230, but in defamation. So defamation can be a statement can be defamatory per se, or just generally defamatory. And if it's defamatory per se, there's presumed damages. But otherwise, you'll have to show damages. And in this case, the plaintiff hadn't shown any damages, so it's, he still ended up losing.
Okay.
But at least got past that hurdle. So I think trying to frame something like that where there is harm caused to you by how they removed your video, they made some type of affirmative statement, and they are, the removal was not based on the content of the video, but based on, you know, some other conduct, like the, you know, trying to falsely build up your likes using
Yeah.
You know, on Twitter, it would be, you know, using ghost multiple accounts or whatever.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Socks or whatever.
To try and test it, and then use that lawsuit to try and link these two provisions. Or in general, I think, you know, there's this right, you know, there's clearly a limitation on the right to censor. It should be done in good faith, according to Section 230. So some other way to get a claim for improper censorship. Mm-hmm. And if social media companies could be required to, you know, if we could require them to act in good faith, at the very least, we'd get notice of it, the censorship, and that would take care of all of the shadow censorship.
Yeah.
And then
they're already setting up like all these hate speech rules. You know, you could basically call anything harassment if you look at it in the right light, or, you know. So at least I'm thinking about Reddit and how they've just been purging inconvenient views that are just as bad or just as good as anybody else's views, but it goes against their narrative that they're obviously shaping a narrative over there.
You know, another way of looking at legal challenge is, to the extent that these social media companies are censoring based on governmental pressure, at some point, you know, when the government tells these companies to do something, even if they don't pass a law, there can be enough pressure put that you could actually say that it is government censorship. So there was there's an old case that dealt with this, is dealing with obscenity, but basically a state legislature created this advisory board that had the authority to declare conduct obscene, or, you know, basically various things obscene. There wasn't any punishment from it. It was just this declaration of this is obscene. And the court held that still amounted to governmental censorship, because the speaker would be feared to be labeled this. And then once they're labeled that, would the cops then try and enforce it or something? And so the court held that action still amounted to censorship, even though it was just this body, you know, saying what it didn't like.
Yeah.
And so it may be that, you know, to the extent that, for example, social media companies, if they were pressured by, you know, any of the elected officials after January 6th to get rid of people, you know, if you could show that they acted because they were pressured by government officials, then you could then say that censorship was private censorship. Certainly, if the government starts enacting laws that, you know, require the removal of hate speech, that'll violate the First Amendment, because that's, again, going to be censoring. And, you know, hate speech is, you know, not a category under the First Amendment that, you know, that can stand.
Yeah.
And so, but I don't think they'll be smart enough not to do that. You know, but it is difficult. And, you know, we have now these states trying to protect, you know, unfair censorship, and that's ultimately going to fail, because Section 230 itself, you know, has a provision that says any state laws that are inconsistent with Section 230 are not valid, and so they'll be preempted by Section 230.
So you're saying that state actions that's trying to enforce social media companies to stop with the censorship that we're talking about are doomed to fail because it violates the free speech of these private companies?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I mean, it is really important to remember that social media companies do have First Amendment rights themselves, and their First Amendment right is to choose who they associate with for the purposes of speech. And so
they're just so big. It's like another category of entity that we're dealing with.
Yeah. But if you think about it, I mean, the fact is that the government has created this massive financial benefit in Section 230. Social media would not exist without Section 230. It just wouldn't be economically viable. They all be sued into oblivion. Yeah. And so we're giving these companies this massive financial benefit. Every cent of Facebook would not exist but for Section 230. So we have a right to ask for something in return. And I think that's what the second section in 230C is trying to do. I think it was intended to be a trade-off, saying, yes, we're going to give you immunity as long as you agree to only censor in this limited manner. And it goes back to the Chubby and Stratmont cases. You know, Chubby didn't censor at all, so they were immune. Stratmont did censor, but very lightly, but then they became a publisher. And I think to that section 230 was designed to say, well, you can still censor lightly and we'll still allow you to avoid liability. Because it really doesn't make any sense otherwise, because there's so few ways that you can be liable for censoring in general, because you have a First Amendment right to only speak what you want to speak.
Or boost the signal that you want to boost.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the, it really isn't doing much otherwise. But we'll have to see where it is. But I think test lawsuits and just continued consciousness on it, I would like to see somebody try and make the claim that the censorship by, especially the stealth censorship by a social media company is extensive enough that they really should be treated as a speaker because they are forming the message. And I think that that's, you know, I think that's a, there's a claim there. It's just going to be a really hard one to prove. And the way these cases go is, so in litigation, especially defamation cases, you'll see it tested after the lawsuit's filed, before the defendant will file an answer, they'll file a motion to dismiss. And that motion to dismiss basically says, you can't prove all the elements, or I have some complete defense. And Section 230 is a, you know, is an immunity provision, so it's a defense. And so the issue of Section 230 usually gets decided at the motion to dismiss stage before there's been any discovery. You have to have really a fairly concrete, you know, allegations to get to discovery. And in cases of conspiracy, which is going to be antitrust cases, the court has made it clear that you can't just say there's a conspiracy. You have to have concrete facts that show that there really is a conspiracy. Because you see this in antitrust all the time. You feel like these two companies are colluding to harm you. But you don't know yet, and the courts have really made it very difficult to get to know, because you can't get to discovery unless you have really concrete allegations. And you can't just make stuff up. As lawyers, you know, we aren't allowed to
really
make stuff up. Yes. We have to base our claims on a good faith investigation, and especially in a complaint when you're affirmatively alleging facts. You know, you could allege facts based on something we call information and belief, but the courts will probe that when it comes to conspiracy claims to say, you know, what information do you have and is it concrete enough? And so I think that making this claim that the social media company's censorship is so extensive that it really is shaping the message and they should be treated as a speaker, I think we all feel the sense that that's happening. But, you know, trying to get enough information to actually allege that would be difficult. Yeah. But, you know, the more we learn, I mean, it may be that some of the facts that have been disclosed through these leaks are enough to give you, you know, concrete enough allegations. But it's also super expensive to go up against these social media companies because they hire the most expensive law firms. They've got basically unlimited resources. And, you know, you're going to have a lot of money behind it as well. But I think, you know, there's some hope in it.
$10 million gun to fire it.
No, it's the court process is not always the best way to bring things, but I think with when Congress is so tied up right now, I think it's maybe the only hope, and it's kind of experimenting on different ways. It is good that the Supreme Court hasn't given a definitive interpretation of 230, and that means that the lower courts, you know, have, you know,
wiggle room,
more discretion than they would otherwise.
Okay.
To accept a good and creative ruling. The other thing is that most of these cases don't even try and link these two provisions because they don't really make sense. Because one is, you're usually, if you're suing for defamation, you want the company to censor someone's speech. So you aren't, so you don't even raise sub two, saying, you know, as a, and how that affects, because you're just complaining that they should have censored. Yeah. You're complaining they censored too much.
Yeah.
And so there isn't, I think there's still plenty of possibility that a brave judge could, you know, adopt a good interpretation of Section 230 that would resolve these issues. It'll take the right facts and the right judge, and all the stars are going to have to be aligned.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the crash course in 230 speech protections. It's really relevant to me, but I really needed to, you know, get an insider view, at least inside your head's insider view of it.
Yeah, no, it was my pleasure. I find this issue fascinating. I think it is very complicated. I think that, I think it would make a lot more understandable with some more time to get kind of some of the basic First Amendment rules down. So I'd be happy to, if you're interested, I'd be happy to kind of take a step back and kind of give a couple 101s. Because when you look at all those, you see where the problems come with this issue. And I think one of the things that people most often miss is the really the authority of the First Amendment rights of social media companies to associate, and how any rule that is prohibiting them from discriminating based on political viewpoints is going to crash into the social media company's rights. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, generally you as an individual have a First Amendment right to discriminate based on viewpoint all you want. You have a right to choose who you talk politics with, and the social media companies do. But I do think that we could make them put their rules in writing ahead of time and enforce them in some type of fair manner and transparent manner. Have you been following at all what Facebook's been doing?
No.
With it, they've created this whole council, and basically it's a mini court system.
Oh God!
But
yeah,
it's if that was done, it's actually they've actually taken I've been impressed with how they've been analyzing the issues, and they certainly have recognized.
Really?
Yeah, they've recognized the importance of fair notice, and context and such, And if those are actually going to end up being enforceable, that's going to give users a lot more rights. But right now, they have full discretion on who they take. And while Facebook has promised to follow their rulings, there's nothing that really requires them to do so. But in theory, on Facebook, you've got more rights than you've ever had before, because these decisions have made it clear that any censorship rule has to be in writing, has to be clear enough for someone to understand, and has to be evaluated in context.
Oh.
They had one case, it was from one Southeast Asian country, I can't remember which one, but they had used a statement that could have been taken as a slur, but in context, you knew it wasn't meant to be a slur. And they reversed and said Facebook shouldn't have removed this post because context. It's a really nuanced decision. And I'm sorry, I'm being a little vague with it. It's been a little while since I read it, but it's a great decision. It's exactly what we would want social media companies to have to do. And, you know, purportedly Facebook is saying they have to do that, but they aren't really doing it because they aren't willing to be bound by it. But
well, that and the amount of content that they'd have to sift through, as opposed to just having an algorithm deal with it, and then a completely non-responsive customer service labyrinth that you put the people through, you know. Yeah.
that is one of the things with the scale of this. And that was, I recently asked a couple law professors who were doing a video conference, and they had open questions on this, and that was their objection to my claim of due process protections. Even is it is just, you know, it, any type of process like that really does bog down the process. But I think that's something that needs to be invested in. I mean, they're making enough money to do it, to give a fair appeals process. And it would also be a lot easier if they simply knew that you know, in order to censor speech, they had to have a rule, and then they had to tell you and give you a timestamp and give you an opportunity to correct it or not. I think they'd come up with a lot clearer rules, and we wouldn't, that would resolve a lot of our complaints without bogging them down, because I think it would just function. We'll see. So
we'll see. Lot to look at too. Well, thank you very much, Ramsey, for your afternoon. It was,
that was my pleasure.
Yeah. I'll have to have you back on to speak more about the first A, number one A. Maybe we can like dabble in the two, but we don't have to go there.
Yeah, the Second Amendment is a morass in and of itself. So, and then I just had to say one other thing, which is that Megan Murphy's hair is amazing, I have to say. Since she went to
Mexico. I was going to bring up her case because she's trying to sue Twitter, as you probably know. But her hair, her Mexico hair, it's just something else.
You just commented on a while back, and I was like, and I made the same, I noticed the same thing.
Congratulations for reaching the end of the discussion. If you enjoyed it, do be sure to leave a review or a comment or a thumbs up or whatever you need to do to show that glorious algorithm that this is some good stuff. And do be sure to go and check that back catalog, as it is brimming full of fantastic conversations. Links to provide monetary support are down there in the description as well. Have a good night.